Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A university system in the state has chosen a new president. We'll hear from him. And another system appears to be waiting before naming a permanent leader. We'll recap a public radio series, Far From Home, looking at how special education students are sent to out-of-state facilities at taxpayer expense. We'll hear from an Illinois family dealing with abuse at the hands of their own child.
The way he will look at me is just evil, is all I can describe it as. And after an incident like that, it's hard to go to sleep thinking that, is he going to come in and attack us while we're sleeping?
If you're traveling this holiday season with a loved one who's suffering from Alzheimer's disease, we have some tips to make things go more smoothly. And speaking of family and holidays, a political argument is a real possibility. We'll find out how some choose to handle those disagreements. That and more coming up this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, we'll recap a series that looks at the number of kids with special education needs from Illinois being sent to out-of-state facilities. The series raises questions about the methods used while Illinois taxpayers are footing the bill. It's the holidays, and along with the many traditions we recognize, how about the good old family argument? We'll have a report. And traveling with someone suffering from Alzheimer's disease can be stressful for both the individual and family members. We'll have some suggestions to make the trip go more smoothly. That's all coming up on Statewide. Victims of domestic violence are advised to seek help. But what do you do if the abuse is coming from your own child? Christine Herman brings us the story of one family in central Illinois wrestling with how to handle their son's aggression.
Jen and Jason's kids have just gotten home from school. Their 15-year-old son ruffles through a stack of papers on the dining room table. He wants to show me some of his latest drawings.
This is a robot with a cape holding a lightsaber. This is just some random goth kid I drew. Some of my pictures are gory, sorry about that.
The teenager and his sister, who's 12, talk through their weekend plans. Maybe play outside or go see a movie. We're not using the kids' names because of the sensitive nature of their family situation. On the surface, the four of them seem like just a typical happy family. While the kids play upstairs, I sit with Jen and Jason, who tell me their blonde-haired, blue-eyed son is smart, funny, and usually pretty kind. But from a very young age, even the littlest things would completely set him off.
We were getting calls from, like, the preschool with him having meltdowns that included, like, hitting and kicking and biting.
His dresser would be pushed across the other side of the room. His bed would be flipped up on the side, you know, so I mean, very violent.
Jen and Jason began fostering the siblings when they were very little and eventually adopted both children. Jen says the kids had been living in an unstable situation involving drugs and domestic violence. Jen says her son remembers being beaten by men in his first home and watching as his biological mom would cut herself. That early life trauma could explain why he has always struggled with impulse control and regulating his own emotions. Jen and Jason started their son in therapy at a young age. His diagnoses include reactive attachment disorder, PTSD, and autism. But his anger remained unpredictable. Earlier this year, he was using vulgar language at home, and Jason told him it was offensive.
For some reason, that just amped him up real fast.
He was hitting the basement door like he was trying to break it. He was kicking the wall. He then at that time took the CD and was going to break it and to try to stab us.
Jen says she's especially worried since her son is now 6 feet tall and directs much of his anger toward her.
The way he will look at me is just evil, is all I can describe it as. And he's threatened to slap me in the face. He's called me all sorts of horrible names. After an incident like that, it's hard to go to sleep thinking that, is he going to come in and attack us while we're sleeping?
To cope with the threats, yelling, and almost daily standoffs, Jen sees a therapist.
It's exhausting. I think we say to each other all the time, like, this is insanity. How can we live like this?
It's hard to know exactly how common Jen and Jason's experience is since research is sparse. One study found about 1 in 10 U.S. families experienced at least one incident of a child acting violently toward a parent in the past year. About a third of those were severe, ranging from punching, kicking, or biting to using a knife or gun. Lily Anderson is a social worker who's worked with hundreds of families in the Seattle area dealing with a violent child.
Parents will often say that they just feel ashamed about it and they don't want to tell their friends or their family members. They do feel a lot of self-blame around it. I should be able to handle my child. I should be able to control this behavior.
Anderson says because many of the incidents take place at home, it's hidden. And that makes it even harder for parents to find support. Carrie Williams manages a Facebook page for parents living with a violent child. Her son became so violent, they had to place him in a residential facility at age 10.
I actually thought I was the only person going through it. I had no idea that this was actually a larger issue than myself.
Williams says people can't imagine a young child can be so violent and dangerous. And she says many parents struggle to accept that they're dealing with a serious domestic violence issue.
Because you just don't want to think like that. And that denial actually is what keeps parents from getting their kids help.
Back in Illinois, Jen says parenting her son, who's now 15, sometimes feels like being stuck in an abusive relationship. But despite all the challenges, she and Jason don't regret adopting their son.
I think it's brought us a ton of joy and a lot of great things have come from it. It's made me a better, stronger person.
She says she just wishes there were more effective treatments.
I feel like we're doing everything that we can for him, but it just seems like it's not enough.
Jen says they've been wrestling with whether to send their son to live at a facility for children with severe behavioral health issues. It's a tough call. They want to keep their family together, but they're also worried about their 12-year-old daughter, who has witnessed a lot of violence. She joins us on the couch, scrunched between her parents. And she tells me she has mixed feelings about sending her brother away.
Well, it makes me feel happy and sad because, well, I love my brother and I know he'll be getting the help he needs.
But she'll also miss him.
Because I just love him and I don't want to see him go through that.
Jen says there needs to be more research on how to really help kids like her son and more places where traumatized parents can turn to find help. For NPR News, I'm Christine Herman.
And after Christine reported this story, Jen and Jason decided to send their son to a residential facility. That reporting comes from a partnership with NPR, Side Effects Public Media, and Kaiser Health. SIU trustees have approved a new president for the Southern Illinois University System. Dan Mahoney is the current president at Winthrop University in South Carolina. Jen Fuller with member station WSIU in Carbondale sat down with Mahoney during an introductory tour of that campus.
Been in higher ed for a long time now, most of my adult life. I was a dean at Kent State for 7 years, and then I've been a president at Winthrop University for the last 4.5 years. And so, again, back to what I talked about, I think my interest in these initially was looking at the footprint of the Southern Illinois University System and the potential for impact. And seeing that this was an institution that really could impact not just the students at the institution, but the whole region, and that was really appealing to me. Also saw some of the challenges from an enrollment standpoint, and I think a lot of what is happening here is already starting to happen other places and may start to look a lot like this in a few years. If we can be successful here, we can be a role model for other institutions about how you kind of move forward in a more challenging enrollment environment, and so that was appealing to me as well.
Do you have any ideas, anything that's worked for you in the past that you think could fit here at Southern?
One is developing what I call destination programs, which are programs that students will come to the university because you have that program that may not have looked at you otherwise. You know, sometimes it's even, I will tell you, and this sounds funny, and I did this back when I was at Louisville, sometimes changing the name of a program can dramatically change interest in the program, even though it's pretty much the same program. And we saw that certainly with the sport management program, where when we did some changes to the name, we doubled the enrollment just by changing the name. And so there's a certain marketing aspect to it as well. We did a lot when I was at Winthrop with how we use our financial aid and using that more effectively. So we're really meeting the needs of the students and figuring out how we distribute that financial aid to get the right student body and making sure students can afford to go there. That helped us out quite a bit. Doing a little bit different with how we recruited and where we targeted. Do we have enough recruiters in the Chicago area? Do we have enough recruiters in the St. Louis area? Do we have enough recruiters? And we did a lot of that at Winthrop as well. And we redid people's regions. We redid the time that they spent in each area. All of that really helped us this past year when we went up about 8.5% on freshman enrollment.
You mentioned diversity earlier, mm-hmm. and you've talked about it a little bit here. Mm-hmm. A lot of people that have been critical of diversity initiatives say there's a difference between diversity and inclusion.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, because I think a lot of times when we talk about diversity, we simply focus on the numbers. And the numbers, without question, are important. Because if you have no numbers, the inclusion part doesn't really matter if you don't actually have the diversity in numbers to start with. But it's not just about the diversity. It's do people feel included? Do people feel welcome? And we did a lot, I think, at the institutions I've been at before. Winthrop certainly, I think, has done a great job in that. We'd always done a pretty good job on the student side. We've done a much more effective job on the faculty and staff side. At Kent, one of the things I did there was we developed an office for diversity outreach and development in my college. And part of our feeling was that the students really didn't feel welcome there. And we changed our numbers dramatically, both in diversity of the students we were attracting, but also our retention. Our retention ended up exceeding the university's retention for our minority students. We were way ahead of everything. We were so effective that the institution actually decided to have every college develop an office just like ours because we became the role model for the rest of the institution. So there are ways of doing things that make people feel included as well as just attracting them to the institution.
You have a somewhat unique perspective compared to administrators we've seen recently in that you have college age and high school age children still. How does that change your perspective in terms of how to run a university and how to attract those students?
Well, I think it gives me a much more realistic perspective. And sometimes I've seen things that the universities did well, others that I think didn't go so well. So I've gone on all the tours with my son and daughter, and I pick up different things, and I look at different things. What can I steal? And that didn't work at all. And one school I can think about that I won't mention it, but that my son went to, that I thought for sure he'd apply to, walked away and had no interest of. And I know why based on some of the things that happened. So you learn from those types of things. But you also realize that some of it, it's hard to judge. Each kid is different. And it's not always a failure when they decide not to come there. It's just my son ended up at a very small school. My daughter will probably be at a very, very big school. They're different kids. And sometimes you lament the fact it's like if you're the small school, how come you couldn't attract that kid? Well, that really wasn't the right fit for them. And understanding each kid has to find their own fit. Understanding that no matter what you do, certain students you're not going to get. And I think having that perspective. Also, I think sometimes we focus too much on the negative of our own institutions and don't realize everybody else has the same challenges we do. So residence halls is always a great example. Our residence halls are awful. No student will come here because of our residence halls. And then they go to tours of other residence halls. It's like, yeah, they're not that much better. And so it gives you a more balanced perspective on what those challenges are.
That's incoming SIU President Dan Mahoney. He'll start his duties March 1st. I'm Jennifer Fuller.
Well, meanwhile, the Western Illinois University Board of Trustees split right down the middle on whether to name Dr. Martin Abraham as the school's next president. Rich Egger spoke to a board member from each side of the issue to get their thoughts.
Four of the eight board members voted in favor of hiring Abraham, who is currently interim president. The proposal failed because it needed a majority to pass. Board Chairperson Polly Radosh backed the resolution. She says the campus and Macomb communities strongly support Abraham.
He has done a fabulous job initially in rallying the community and the institution and has come in with fresh ideas. So I was very hopeful that the board would appoint. And then when we did not, of course I'm disappointed, but we must move forward and we've got to unify as a board to get the job done to complete the search process. And I sincerely hope that he is a candidate in the search.
Are you afraid that a search and however long that might take is going to slow down Western's ability to move forward?
Yes, I am. I'm very nervous about that. We have a high percentage, almost all, in fact, of our upper administration in interim positions, and it's very difficult to find candidates who would come here not knowing who their boss is going to be. So selecting candidates to fill those interim positions is going to be a huge, huge challenge.
What characteristics or qualities are you looking for in Western's next president?
I'm looking for someone who is able to unite the campus in much the same way that Martin has already done this. We have turned around so quickly in the last few months that it is you almost have whiplash by how quickly people have rallied to his programs and ideas and initiatives. So I would hope we would be able to find someone who would also be able to rally the campus.
WIU Board of Trustees Chairperson Polly Radosh says 67% of those who responded to a survey support hiring Martin Abraham as president right now. Yet four board members voted against doing so. One of them is Greg Aguilar. He believes the university should conduct a national search to ensure transparency.
In order for us to create equitable opportunities for people to apply for positions, it's important that we have an open and equitable process. I felt that we owed it to the state and we owed it to Western Illinois University to have that process, and that is to do a national search.
Are you concerned at all about how long that search might take, and we continue on with interim administrators on the campus?
When President Thomas stepped down, we knew as a board we had to take quick action. And we did not hesitate, and we voted unanimously to put the provost into the presidential position so that we would have a leader and to move this university forward. I know that we still have a leader in Dr. Abraham. I know that there is a lot he is doing and will continue to do. And because it is time is of the essence, this is why we started a search immediately, because we do understand the challenges of not having people in leadership roles.
So what characteristics or qualities will you be looking for in Western's next president?
I would love to see people with innovative ideas, people who have demonstrated action and success in having successful town and gown relationships. I'm looking for someone who has, I think we're all looking for as trustees, is someone who understands the business side, but also respects and honors the academic side, which is the university.
WIU Board of Trustees member Greg Aguilar says he hopes Martin Abraham will apply for the president's job during the national search. The university will form a 23-member committee to conduct that search. The committee is authorized to spend up to $250,000. The search could take 12 to 18 months. Rich Egger reporting.
There's more of Statewide ahead. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still ahead this hour, if you're traveling with someone suffering from Alzheimer's disease, we have some recommendations to make for a less stressful trip. That and more still on the way. More than 650 downstate firefighter and police pension systems will now be consolidated into just two statewide funds. Governor J.B. Pritzker signing that plan into law this week. Officials estimate that local departments could collectively see an extra $2.5 billion in investment returns over the next 5 years. Pritzker says consolidation will accomplish several goals.
Working together, we are helping hundreds of cities all across the state of Illinois to alleviate their spiraling property tax burdens. And just as importantly, we're showing that Illinois can tackle its most intractable problems.
First responders will make up a majority of both of the statewide pension boards. Consolidating the funds and setting up the boards is expected to take more than 2 years. Last year, Illinois changed its school code to limit options for districts sending special needs students out of state. Under the change, districts are no longer able to send students to states that don't provide residential oversight. But some families quickly found a way around the new law. Our education reporter Dusty Rhodes explains.
That amendment might as well have been called the Utah Law, because even though the plain language doesn't mention Utah, that's the state it excluded. Stephanie Jones was general counsel for the State Board of Education in 2017, and she helped push through that new law. But today, she acknowledges that families quickly found a workaround. Parents enroll their child in a private facility, pay the cost up front, and then seek reimbursement from the school district. So I had to ask, why would parents want to send kids someplace all the way on the other side of the country and there's no oversight?
That is a fantastic question. I have never understood why, when we've raised issues of, you know, the school doesn't have special education teachers, doesn't have oversight by DCFS, why either parents or hearing officers or parents' attorneys think that they're appropriate placement.
Ted's six-month stay at Discovery Academy in Utah was completely paid for by his parents. He was there as a condition of a plea agreement to get a drug charge dropped in Indiana, which is why 5 years later, he still doesn't want us to use his last name.
When I was packing for there, I was bringing all sorts of things like my lacrosse stick and all my clothes and my cell phone and my wallet and ID, and as soon as I got there, they take everything away. They stripped me completely naked and did a search. No cavity search, but I did do jumping jacks.
Initially, Ted was considered a flight risk.
When I was on run watch and I was sleeping on the floor, there was a kid next to me, and he sliced his neck with this razor in the middle of the night, and I woke up in a pool of blood. I'm like, oh, I'm in some. Like, this is not normal place, you know?
Your mom told me that at one point you called her crying and said, get me out of here, I'd rather just do the jail time.
Yeah, so, no, I said that multiple times, very many times. I still say it today.
Ted was 17 when he was at Discovery, and he says it didn't take him long to realize he needed to play along with the program, even though it meant essentially lying.
I mean, I had this entire pamphlet of me promising my therapy, myself, and my parents that I would never drink alcohol, and I'm not even old enough to drink alcohol right now, you know, but I had to sign this packet and talk about it with my parents in order to graduate the system.
Avital Van Leeuwen found herself at another Utah boarding school, Alpine Academy, in 2011, having been sent there by the Los Angeles School District. Like Ted, she realized there was no escape and resigned herself to playing along.
Actually, one of the most traumatizing parts of being there, I had to stand up in front of everyone and read this speech that they make all of us do called Yes, I'm Getting Better. And I had to like put on this show and this smile of like loving the place and having had a great experience when all I was thinking about was how horrible it was and how much I couldn't wait to get out.
Keegan Autry, who's from Arizona, was one of Van Leeuwen's classmates. To him, the worst part was the use of isolation as a punishment.
You wouldn't be allowed to talk to people, either for a day or up to weeks, if you did something that was quote-unquote bad enough.
The worst thing you could do was kiss a girl, and odds are you'd get caught.
There were cameras in the home. You had no privacy. I didn't even feel safe in my own thoughts. It felt like I wasn't even allowed to think badly of Alpine, and I think that's partially why I started loving Alpine in a way.
For a couple of years after graduation, Autry felt intensely loyal to Alpine, but he says troubling memories kept bubbling up in his mind.
It took a lot of time for it to sink in, like just the depth of how wrong a lot of the things that happened there were.
Looking back, Keegan Autry, and that's now legally his name, realizes he was struggling with gender dysphoria. Alpine is an all-girls school, and since Autry was assigned female at birth, he was expected to behave as a girl. Illinois banned conversion therapy in 2015, but the law does not cover Illinois students residing out of state. I'm Dusty Rhodes.
In an email response, the director of Alpine Academy said the school instituted a policy of honoring masculine and non-binary gender pronouns around 2016 and has never had a general policy against masculine dress, though it may have been a part of certain students' individual therapy. All this week, Dusty has been sharing a series of stories about special education students placed in private facilities in other states, how many students, who pays for the placements, and why Illinois passed that law banning placements in the state of Utah. She joins me now to discuss the project. So, Dusty, how many of these kids actually leave Illinois for school?
Close to 350 for residential placement. Another 140 or so are in therapeutic day school. Mostly in the St. Louis area.
So what kind of disabilities do these students have?
Wisconsin has about 55 Illinois students. They're certified for several disabilities: intellectual, TBI, autism, emotional disability. Ohio has about 30 students. They're mainly kids with autism. Missouri has more than 50 living at Great Circle, where they treat autism, emotional disability, intellectual disability, developmental delay, a whole range of things. Another 25 are at a place on Lake of the Ozarks where they just treat emotional disability and a thing called other health impairment. Other health impairment is a disability classification that includes ADD and ADHD. But Utah has more than 80. All these numbers that I'm mentioning are from the 2017-18 school year. And Utah seems to specialize in the emotional disability. What makes this kind of ironic to me is at the same time that I was doing all this research, I was also working on a story about a place in Harvey, Illinois, called Children's Habilitation Center, where the children are, it's basically like a pediatric nursing home, and the children have profound needs. They're all on feeding tubes, ventilators. A lot of them have traumatic brain injuries and just severe developmental delays. The Harvey School District has disenrolled several of the kids to avoid paying for their tuition. The program's run by a woman with a PhD in special education. The teachers are all certified. That's not true for the programs in Utah, and they don't necessarily have special ed teachers or certified teachers at all. This place has a certified staff, children with profound disabilities, and nobody wants to pay for them. But we are paying for these other students to leave the state.
So, Dusty, how do these kids often get to these schools?
Yeah, so a lot of kids arrive in Utah via a method called therapeutic transport. Kids call it kidnapping. And it's where two people come into your bedroom in the middle of the night and wake you up and have you get dressed. And very quickly, they take you to the airport and put you on a plane. Of course, this is done with your parents' consent. Your parents come in and usually say something, you know, like, I love you, and then they disappear into another part of the house so that the transporters say that it can escalate the situation if the parents stay in the room, so they have them go somewhere else. And the kids are taken that way. It seems to be, for some students, really traumatic. That's another thing that we as taxpayers are funding, is this particular mode of getting kids to these out-of-state placements, especially in Utah.
And not all of them do it that way, but in some cases that happens.
Well, the young adults that I interviewed said it's more common than not.
Well, you mentioned emotional disability. What does that entail?
It is a kind of vague term, isn't it? And I've been told that it was once called behavioral disorder. The definition on the State Board of Education website includes schizophrenia. I'm going to just read you these four things. An inability to learn that cannot be explained by intellectual, sensory, or health factors. An inability to build or maintain satisfactory interpersonal relationships with peers and teachers. Inappropriate types of behavior or feelings under normal circumstances. A general pervasive mood of unhappiness or depression, or a tendency to develop physical symptoms or fears associated with personal or school problems, which, I don't know, sound like teenagers. but the difference between just teenage angst and emotional disability is that these things have to have occurred over a long period of time to a degree that adversely affects a child's educational performance.
Earlier, you mentioned the different states where students are placed, and quite a few in Utah, and yet the state had made an effort to try to stop sending students there, but yet that's still happening.
I forgot to mention that we pay for these placements, okay? And I mean, it's shared among school districts, so property taxes, plus state taxes, plus federal taxes. They each pay for a piece. And there's a workaround called unilateral placement, where parents can go place the child in a private facility and then come back to the school district and get it written into the child's IEP. An IEP, that means individualized education plan, and that if your child is in special education, they have an IEP. What attorneys who represent school districts have told me that parents are doing this sometimes even when their child is not in special education, does not have an IEP. Parents who can front the money can go place their child out of state in a private facility and then come back to the school district and ask to have an IEP created for their child. This can happen even if the child has never attended that school, never been in the public school district. So it can be a family who's had their child in private school and just something has happened, usually some kind of psychiatric crisis or some kind of emotional crisis, and they have determined that the child needs round-the-clock care and that out-of-state would be the best place.
Recently, Chicago Tribune and ProPublica partnered up on an investigation that looked into seclusion, sort of rooms that were set apart, where kids could almost basically be locked in and during school times. That became an issue. A lot of people have been talking about that. None of these schools seem to show up on that type of reporting.
The facilities featured in that investigation are all public facilities, and they have logs of seclusion because they're required to have logs of seclusion. Private facilities were not. The State Board of Education responded to that investigation by creating emergency rules, so now the private facilities are. But these schools, like the schools in Utah, I interviewed young adults who live there, and they talked about there are, they call them more like solitary confinement rooms because they've got a bed and, you know, you could be there for not just hours but days. So they definitely have seclusion, and they also have a different way of doing seclusion at these places. They do like a social isolation. Like at Discovery Academy, if you're wearing a certain color shirt, that signals to everyone that you can't talk. They can't talk to you. They wouldn't have shown up in this report because they're private.
So does anybody have an answer when it comes to this issue?
People who understand evidence-based funding, our new funding formula here in Illinois, might be familiar with the tier system. There's tier one schools have less than 67% of the resources they need. Tier four schools have more than 100% of the resources they need. It's those two tiers that seem to be accessing these out-of-state placements the most. Tier one schools, low-income families have access to pro bono attorneys who can try to get help for kids with severe needs. And tier four schools, those parents have access to attorneys that they hire themselves. Attorneys seem to be kind of crucial in the process. There's a guy named Jim Kling who has a service that more districts are trying to write into IEPs, where he's a behavioral consultant. He comes to your home for a flat fee and tries to train the parents on how to deal with the students themselves to keep them in their home instead of shipping them off.
That's Dusty Rhodes. Her series on out-of-state placements called Far From Home is online now. You can find a link at our website at statewideshow.com. Well, this week, hundreds of farmers, processors, and researchers gathered at the Illinois State Fairgrounds to talk about hemp. Dana Cronin reports from the Hemp Summit in Springfield.
It's been over a year since former Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner legalized growing hemp in the state. And 1 year later, growers, processors, and government officials have learned a lot. The purpose of the summit in Springfield was to spread that knowledge around. The event was sold out with almost 700 registrations. Jared Payton grows hemp in Wayne City, Illinois.
Yeah, I was assuming there'd be a couple hundred people here. You know, I never realized or even imagined it would be this big. So this is great.
He says hemp is stigmatized where he lives, so he was shocked at the turnout. Hemp is related to marijuana, but has less tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, which gives marijuana its psychoactive effect. I'm Dana Cronin.
We'll be back with more of Statewide. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, that holiday tradition, the family argument. We'll take a closer look. A Northern Illinois middle school class is part of the National Christmas Tree Celebration in Washington, D.C. Peter Medlin reports the Loves Park students created an ornament representing Illinois.
The 24 Harlem Middle School art students worked on the 24 ornaments in secret. The National Park Service didn't let the kids say anything about their project until the official announcement. So while the 7th graders spent afternoons crafting the state ornament, they spent their days dodging questions from friends.
I would have to make up a different reason every time.
That's Peyton.
I would just say art stuff and then kind of walk away.
And instead of having each student make an ornament, their exploratory art teacher Ruth Meisen says they decided everyone should work on every ornament. And Meisen said they decided on only using one design for all of them.
It's not just representing our school. How do we represent our state? So we agreed on going with the white oak tree as one of the symbols of strength.
The white oak leaves circle the green ornaments, and they have an outline of the state with the slogan, "Peace and Joy from Illinois," and a heart dangles from the bottom of the ornament as an homage to their hometown. The students' handiwork now hangs on a tree on the famous Ellipse of Presidents Park in Washington, D.C., just outside of the White House, along with 55 other trees representing every state, territory, and the District of Columbia. It's expected that more than 200,000 tourists could see their tree this year. And it was hard to imagine all of those eyes on their ornaments while the 7th graders were secretly decorating them months ago. Gabrielle says that part didn't bother them, though.
More pressure was going into how many people we were representing.
Their teacher Ruth Meisen says only finishing touches remained for the ornaments by the time everyone else even found out about it.
It's just kind of like cooking a big meal. You've been working with all the ingredients for so long, and you get near the end, you're like with a meal, you're like, does this even taste good anymore? I'm not even sure.
After the many hours putting the ornaments together, Meisen said she wanted to make sure the students had a chance to go to Washington, D.C. and see the tree lighting ceremony in person. So they created a GoFundMe and started fundraising to cut costs for the families. Meisen said donations made a difference, and most students made the trip. Before the tree lighting ceremony began, they were whisked behind the ropes to see their tree first. Of course, they also moved some ornaments around and fixed a few branches.
We're art people, so we judged it.
And Meisen said she lit up when someone from the education department told her Illinois was their favorite.
It was a real proud moment because these are 7th graders who did those ornaments, and many of the ornaments were made by high school students.
And when the students saw their tree for the first time, well, Adriana said,
it didn't seem real. Like, I thought it was a dream, but it was actually really amazing to see them, from us just working on them in here to going to see them in front of many people.
Gabrielle said they even felt a little like proud parents to their 5-inch ornaments.
If you could imagine your kid graduating from college.
Then came the tree lighting ceremony. And just after that, Meisen said they ran over to the White House Visitor Center, where their ornament was also featured front and center on a tree.
That actually got me emotional seeing that.
Maritza says her class understands the significance of this opportunity.
When's another time that you're going to be able to be chosen to do this? So you just got to like take it and just be happy with it.
Now that the art students are back in Loves Park, they're finishing up a few leftover ornaments that they're planning to give to some of the people who helped support their trip. I'm Peter Medlin.
travel during the holidays can be stressful. It can be even more so with a loved one suffering from Alzheimer's disease in tow. But the Alzheimer's Association has some tips to make things easier, and I talked with the association's Elizabeth Cook. It seems as though that some of the best advice is no surprises for people.
I would agree. I would say the best advice for people traveling for the holidays with someone living with Alzheimer's would be to plan ahead and to allow for extra time. It's advised to travel to known destinations, try to visit places and people that are familiar and will cause less stress and not overwhelm the person with Alzheimer's that you're traveling with.
Now, one of the tips I saw was also listed was to pick the time that is best for the individual who is suffering from Alzheimer's. And that seems like something most families might not think about, that there are times that are better than others for someone.
And it all depends on the person living with the disease. If the daytime or nighttime, it really just depends. But they know that person and they know how easily they get frustrated or overwhelmed or confused. So they'll be able to use that information in order to travel at the best time for them, if any. Sometimes it might be easier for family to come to them and make sure that they stay in an environment that they're most comfortable with. But you really kind of have to sit down, discuss it with your family, take a look at the person living with the disease and decide what is best for them.
And I would guess it can be frustrating as well for other family members, especially those that may not be around this person all the time. They maybe expect the person to remember them or certain events, you know, certain names. Any advice for how people can handle that?
Sure. I would definitely say the caregiver for the person living with Alzheimer's should either sit down or schedule a conference call with family if they're hosting a holiday gathering. Let them know what to expect, just so there's no surprises. Let them know where the person living with Alzheimer's is and let them know where they are in the caregiving process. Changes can happen frequently with a person with Alzheimer's, but it's best for the caregiver to let the family members and friends know where that person is and what they can expect when they come to visit.
And I know it can be stressful and difficult to bring a person that's having this type of issue to an event because of that, because it is the extra work that may be part of a family gathering. Do they often get left behind?
Actually, it can happen. So here at the Alzheimer's Association, we try to give people tips in order to involve the person with Alzheimer's. You can look to involve your loved one in meaningful activities such as singing holiday songs or looking through photo albums and doing activities like looking through different, you know, musical CDs that they liked. It's really important to try to involve the person with the holiday celebrations and traditions without overwhelming them.
Is it also a time of the year for families to, you know, especially those that aren't around this individual that often, is it a good time for them to take notice of changes?
Yes, it's an excellent time to say, you know, to your family, I've noticed some changes in mom. She's having some memory loss issues. I just noticed some, even if it's slight changes that may be concerning to you. We definitely recommend to call our 24/7 helpline at 800-272-3900. They're open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, even on holidays. And you can ask any concerning questions that you have about your loved ones. They'll be able to answer any questions you have about the signs and symptoms of Alzheimer's disease and maybe help relieve some of your anxiety surrounding it.
I believe it was someone from your organization a couple of years ago I spoke with, and they gave me some good advice, I felt, and I just wanted to repeat it and get your thoughts on this. But I mentioned to them, should people worry if they or a loved one starts misplacing items like their keys or forgetting, you know, just, you know, typical things they would normally know about? They said the real concern is when you don't remember what an item is for, such as you put your keys in the refrigerator. Can you elaborate on that, on when we should be a little more concerned that we may be seeing the onset of Alzheimer's disease?
I would say the best way to describe it is memory loss that affects your daily life. So yes, if all of a sudden mom has a cookie recipe that she's known for 40 years and all of a sudden can't remember how to do it, or is constantly misplacing items, or, you know, anything concerning like that, where there shouldn't be a reasonable explanation why she was experiencing that memory loss, I would definitely reach out, ask questions, get together with her family, see if they're noticing the same signs and symptoms. Sometimes it is easily explainable, such as, you know, medication or just, you know, regular aging memory loss. But it's always a good idea to just get it checked out and then also reach out to us at any time to ask questions about, you know, what those changes look like and what, you know, some explanations could be behind them.
That's Elizabeth Cook. She's with the Alzheimer's Association. You can find out more, including the hotline number that she spoke about, at our website at statewideshow.com. Well, millions of Americans will soon be gathering with loved ones. Eric Stock reports on a fine old tradition of the dinner table political arguments.
Everyone has a holiday horror story, but it's not easy to keep controversy away from the holiday, not perhaps even advisable. Illinois State University student Rachel Lawrence's tale of woe begins with her mom missing Thanksgiving because she was sick.
My mom usually keeps my dad in check, and she wasn't there, so they got into a fight about my grandma, and there was a lot of yelling, and the rest of the day we had to have them on separate floors. It was not good.
Rachel says she handled it by bailing.
I looked at my uncle and I told him I'm going to go get more mashed potatoes and left. That's really bad, but I didn't feel getting involved, so I heard the very end of it as I was going upstairs.
Escape routes are crucial when the subject matter gets to a place you don't want to go.
I think I left my lights on. I'll be right back.
Joe Faust is the father of an ISU student who lives in Wisconsin. Faust says he sees a lack of civility across our culture, not just at the holidays. He says spirited discussion often goes too far.
It seems like the majority of the population all across the spectrum is not happy with the slow, steady progress towards a stated ideal. They want somebody to come in and punch them in the nose and tell them where to head out, you know, and it's people are frustrated.
Different family members have different roles. The referee, the enforcer, the peacemakers, and yes, just about every family has an instigator to stir the pot on hot-button issues. For ISU student Annika Allworth, that's Uncle Bob.
He's a pastor, and he's just really, strict about his beliefs. And him and my dad don't get along on, politics. So if anything comes up, it's just really awkward.
Allworth says she doesn't let that ruin the holidays.
It's a little hard because you just want to enjoy family, but people can have conflicts and that's kind of annoying, but overall it's fine.
Some families have rules to keep the peace. ISU student Anne Marie Schutt says potentially divisive topics are off limits when passing the turkey at the table.
Politics, we kind of avoid that topic. We don't really talk about it that much. So I think it's kind of just everybody stays neutral. We don't really talk about if we have any extreme beliefs that we don't know if everybody agrees with, we don't really talk about it.
Avoidance might seem necessary, but some experts on interpersonal communication say it can be unhealthy, too. That's according to Dr. Jonathan Lindsay. He owns a psychological counseling service in Bloomington. Lindsay says many people deal with anxiety, depression, and discomfort during the holidays, largely because they feel isolated, even from their own families.
All of that can really coalesce during the holiday season when people want to be cheerful and they want to have that kind of holiday magic that we put in all of our movies. And instead, they are dreading family interactions or just not knowing how to talk and love each other during these dark times.
Lindsay says generation gaps between baby boomers and millennials are widening. Gen Xers in the middle feel increasingly left out. Lindsay works with the clients on learning how to listen and speak with empathy. He says that's what's usually missing when conversations turn ugly.
That skill can be really, really difficult to turn on when we're in a heated moment, when people are talking about things that we think are terrible or very harmful.
Lindsay says speaking with compassion is better than walking away. He says it's unlikely you're going to change the mind of someone with diametrically opposed views, but that's not the point.
But if I'm there in order to, use my voice, if I'm there to express myself and I can just focus on meeting my need to do that, I might be able to walk away from that conversation feeling like my needs are met, versus if I focus on changing crazy uncle's way of doing things, I might be left just agitated and hurt.
And for those who abstain from stirring the pot, ISU student Anne Marie Schutt.
It's nice, if we're all just together. That's what matters.
Schutt says she's grateful her family isn't trying to win political arguments when they gather during the holidays. She says her family gatherings are often boring, and that's okay. I'm Eric Stock.
Dr. Lindsay says politics have always been an issue that can divide families, but he sees deeper divisions these days. He says social media plays a role in widening those divisions by revealing opinions we might otherwise have kept to ourselves. And here's hoping you have a happy and not too argumentative holiday season. That wraps up this week statewide. Thanks for joining us. We're glad you could be with us, and we hope you'll tune in again next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. All of our episodes can be found at statewideshow.com. Our podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations. Thank you.